The last time, we finished chapter 7, right on the nose. But we didn't cover the review. And so just a quick review. Stuff we've been through many, many times now. So we keep on asking just to get our minds on track. Like, what does Ecclesiastes mean?
Preacher.
And what was the question of this whole book?
What profit is there in life?
What profit is there in life? And what was the answer?
All is vanity.
All is vanity. All is futile. And then the focus of the book that we need to keep in our minds at all times is reading these chapters.
Life under the sun.
Everything, yeah, has to do with life under the sun. And the outline. Who can do the outline? Stumped everybody.
1:1-4 is intro. 1:5-6-12 is vanity of earthly endeavor. 7:1-12:8 wisdom for application in life. 12:9-14 conclusion.
Yes. He passes.
Did you say 1:1-4?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I think that's a little different from Michael's, isn't it?
You it's close enough.
And I think
there's a bell curve applied.
I think I did. Oh, that's right. It's 1:2, isn't it?
1:3. 1:3.
Well, I don't understand that. How can it be 1:3? I mean, what's the breaking point? I don't see why there's a breaking point there.
Oh, at 3?
Mm-hmm.
Because 1:4, 1:3.
Why isn't it 1:2? I mean,
because the question's in 3, the answer's in 2. And then 4 starts our never-ending cycle.
Okay, so it's 1:3?
Yeah, 1:3. That's okay, you're close. No one else is that close.
Let me straighten that out.
Tonight we were beginning on chapter 8. And of course, according to the introduction... According to the outline we just discussed, we're continuing in the topic of wisdom for application in our lives. And beginning here in verses 1 through 10, we discuss the adversity of a wicked ruler and the wisdom we apply if we find ourselves in such circumstances. And I asked, had a question, to select all the phrases that describe this ruler. I called him wicked ruler, but how do we know what this ruler is? What does the context say? This is what y'all talk.
I didn't know what you meant. I couldn't find exactly what you're talking about.
I guess, how do we know what type of ruler we're dealing with here? What particular phrases or descriptions are given of this ruler to describe him?
Where do you see that?
Where did I see the description of
him? Jim, where do you see wicked and evil about a ruler?
I thought there was some application of that.
Yeah.
That verse 10 is talked about, isn't it?
I think verse 10 is talking about him.
Yeah. I guess it has to be because it just referred to the one.
Well, it doesn't necessarily. I'm not saying it has to say wicked, but what if anything found in the text says what the ruler is? Does it say he's a good ruler? Does it say he's a so-so ruler? Anything?
Verse 12 talks about.
This is 1 to 10. Right.
Yes, 1 to 10. There's nothing there to talk about? I mean, I'm not saying that it applies to what I say, but just anything that describes him.
Well, one thing, he's got absolute authority. He says, verse 4, the word of the king is authoritative. He's not like the president of this country that's going to get something passed by the House and Senate. He says, cut his head off, and your head goes off.
Yeah. Verse 4, you say, yeah, exactly. What the word of the king there is power. And follow up with that, it says, you know, no one's going to ask this person, what are you doing? Like in our country, Mr. Funder just said, president can't do whatever he wants. He has to go by the senators and congressmen and the judges. But this one, no one asks him what he's doing. What he does, and it's without question. He has absolute authority. So he has power, he has absolute authority. That doesn't say he's wicked, but that's something that describes him. What else? What other verses describe him?
What about verse 9?
Yes, verse 9. What does it say?
Where a man has exercised authority over man through his hurt.
And here it talks about he exercises authority to the hurt, either his own hurt or the hurt of others. Mm-hmm. Either way you take it, there's something wrong. He's hurting himself or hurting others. There's something wrong with his ruling ability. And Mr. Porter also mentioned number 10. I take that to be the ruler as well. It says it saw the wicked buried and gone from the place of holiness where they were forgotten in the city. I think that's talking about the ruler. It's just falling with the context. But also, well,
Possibly, if it's not talking about authority, maybe it talked about verse 3, the end of the verse, that he's capricious, he just does whatever's on the whim, whatever he pleases.
Yeah.
So he's in a bad mood today. He's got all his authority. You better be careful about this guy.
Exactly that. He does whatever he pleases him. So, and of course, a lot of times what pleases people isn't always the right thing, the good thing, is it? But he's going to do whatever it is that he desires. So verse 3, verse 4, verse 9 and 10. Anyone else have any others?
I just want to make a comment. I'd like to just time back to, I guess, the concern about a word for breaking and death. Depends on where it's found. But even if it's not a wicked ruler, even if it's just a ruler, there's still wisdom in what's being said here.
Correct.
And so, at least I don't get from he'll do whatever he pleases. I mean, that's what a king does. That's just an extra king. David did whatever he pleases. Solomon did whatever he pleased. In that sense, relative to the man he was speaking. Now, he was guided by something else, but was still what he pleased. It's the nature of kings.
Yeah.
Whether they're wicked or not wicked.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point to take. I still think this one's wicked to some extent. So you're absolutely right.
If 10's talking about him, right?
And 9.
Indicates he is wicked.
Yes. I also think in verse 8, it talks about, we'll get there more, where it's talking about there it's at the end, it says, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. And this is talking about the end judgment of all men. And this talking about he has power, yet his power isn't going to save him from death. And neither will his wickedness save those who do wickedly.
I just had a hard time finding in here that the king was necessarily wicked. It was like Wally said, whatever pleases him doesn't have to be wicked. And when it's talking about the wicked buried, are we still on a king there? I mean, even in verse 9, there is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. That doesn't even indicate that he's wicked to me. I guess I just had trouble once with your heading, and I really couldn't get going on that.
Okay.
I'm not...
Here's your verse 8. Maybe you can explain verse 8 when he gets there.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, I also had verse 6 that the talking about the judgment is offset, and until that time the judgment comes, the misery of man increases. So here's this ruler, and there's misery to men as he rules. I think there's this belief that he can be delivered by his own power and his own wickedness from death. Of course, we know that's not the case. In verse 9, he rules over to others to his own hurt. And in verse 10, it talks about the wicked is buried. I think altogether, it defines this ruler as a wicked ruler. Even if it doesn't, any ruler where you talk about absolutes, absolutely wicked or absolutely good, this ruler, I think, has some levels of, maybe he's not absolutely wicked, but he has some faults. And with his power and the fact that there's no higher authority in him, there's no one to question him, men, can go to some, do things that aren't right, even if, say, necessarily they aren't wicked. We know David messed up. We know Solomon messed up. No one's perfect. No man's perfect. So as long as one man has absolute power, he's going to do things that are wrong at times. Now, that maybe that's not, we can't classify everyone who does something wrong at times as wicked, because all of us do things wrong.
Well,
I think it is. He's wicked. But
another thing, he said necessarily prudent, but in the text also talks about what the one underneath that would command us to do. Now, he used to act even though that person may be,
And yeah, and regardless of whether he's wicked or he's not, any shade between, this is the application of how we are supposed to be wise in dealing with one such as this, whether he's wicked or not. Even if he's not wicked, how to deal with a ruler who does as he pleases when it doesn't suit you.
I was looking at verse 3. It says, "Do not be in a hurry to leave him, and do not join the evil matter, or he will do whatever he pleases." Well, that's talking about obviously against the ruler, and you think that someone would have reason for wanting to do evil against us. Not necessarily. It doesn't state that. You have to go off it. But just within the context,
I think that might be taking some assumptions there. Yeah. I don't think about the take. And maybe I'm just wrong. But that's my conclusion. but we see in verse 1 what the attitude of the wise is in the situation of this ruler who is powerful, who does as he pleases. In verse 1, "Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed." And I think this is first talking about the attitude of the wise man. It's talking here about who is wise, the interpretation of a thing. If a man knows, within the context, we're talking about the interpretation or who understands this situation of a wicked ruler, and thus, if you can interpret this case you find yourself in, you'll know how to act appropriately. And we see here, he talks about the sternness of his face is changed. The wise man's attitude is revealed in his expression. He wasn't stern, it was changed. What does stern mean? I have the definition written down, but you usually have a negative connotation with stern. As stern, as it's defined in the dictionary, we use it as a hardness or severity in nature or manner, or also a forbidding or gloomy appearance. I know when I get on to my kids, I get stern with them. And they're not, "Yay, Daddy's ready to play." They're, "Ooh, something's up." It's not a happy face. And so there's this hardness, there's this severity there. I think if someone is stern like that all the time, or stern in this situation, it reveals an attitude of bitterness or resentment or just, not satisfied with the situation we find ourselves in. And in this situation is dealing with this ruler with all this authority, and they must not agree with it. But we see the man whose sternness has changed, his face shines. If you turn to Numbers 6:24... Let's talk about the Lord. "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." And here we see that phrase, "the Lord's face shines upon you." I think that's, again, describing what else does he say here? When the Lord's face isn't stern upon you, it shines upon you. And what attitude befits with that? In this context, in this verses, you see that he's gracious to you, that he provides peace, that he lifts up your countenance, that he blesses you. These are all positive things. Also in Psalm 67, verse 1. God be merciful to us and bless us and cause His face to shine upon us. And here we see the same idea of a positive event is providing mercy and again blessings. And so this shining is something that's positive. It's more like it's a softened feelings. I have it as, you know, someone serene or is calm. I guess appropriately is someone's more apt to bestow kindness or grace or peace, and that's going to enable someone to cope with this situation. Is bitterness and resentment, dissatisfaction going to enable you to cope with the situation any better? Because we can't change the situation, right? With the ruler, you can't do anything about it. So the only thing you can change is your own attitude. And then we know if you have that angry attitude, of course it's going to make you more apt to do something foolish. We just read in chapter 7, we're talking about, you know, slow to anger. Those who aren't or have the possibility to do something foolish. So you see here the attitude that the wise man should have. What are the actions that identify one as wise? What advice is given here in 2 through 5? How is one advised to live or behave with such a ruler? In verse 2.
Keep the commandments.
And we keep the commandments of the ruler, right? And in verse 3. What advice is given here?
You know, are you deserting the gap underneath his rule and deal with somebody else who's trying to do treat or deal against him?
Yeah, well, I mean, mine specifically says don't leave his presence hastily. And that alone, just within that context, what that says, don't leave his presence hastily, that's an advice to follow. And, well, we'll get into it in a second, why that is. But I think when you're leaving someone hastily, it shows anger or dissatisfaction. You know, you talk to someone and you take off. That person's not happy. That person's dissatisfied. And that, to a king, of course, you can be disrespectful. And this guy has absolute authority. It could be impertinent. It could be read any number of ways, and most of them not positively. And so, with this person who, like, and in that verse it says he does whatever he pleases, you're going to do something that shows you in a negative light. And he's about to turn on you. He could then take that negatively and turn on you. So, I mean, I'm getting into the reasons behind it. But in verse 5, what else does he say we should follow?
It's a proper way to handle yourself, a proper time to have a disagreement and to,
yeah, keep the royal commandments. Yeah, keep the royal. So we see the same advice again. Keep the commandments of the king. And so why is this advice? What is that? Why is this behavior advisable? why should we follow this advice to keep the commandments of the king? We don't want to bring trouble upon yourself. We see in verse 2, we say, keep the commandments of the king, and he gives a reason. He says, keep the commandments of the king for the sake of your oath to God. And of course, we know, you know, as rulers, as subjects, they're subject to them. You know, a lot of times, people make oaths to them. If we were looking in 1 Chronicles 29, 24... Verse 24, or starting from 23, then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord as king instead of David, his father, and prospered, and all Israel obeyed him. In 24, all the leaders and the mighty men, and also all the sons of King David, submitted themselves to King Solomon. And so these people are submitting. They're, you know, giving fealty, as they say, or giving service to him. I think that is, in part, you know, an oath, a promise to, I'm going to serve you, O King. But also in Ezekiel 17, I don't have to go into too much detail about it, because we know that's what happens. You know, new kings come on board, and everyone bends a knee and vow of service to him, gives oath of service for favor. But in 17:12-19, says, "Say now, this is the Lord saying, say now to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Tell them, indeed, the king of Babylon went to Jerusalem and took its kings and princes and led them with him to Babylon. And he took the king's offspring, made a covenant with him and put him under oath. He also took away the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be brought low and not lift itself up, but that by keeping his covenant it might stand." And so we know that if you read back in the end of 2 Kings, Babylon took over Israel, and they took the kings and the princes, and they took a new leader, a cousin, and set him on a throne and made him swear fealty, or, you know, an oath of service to the king of Babylon. And it continues. In 15, "But he rebelled against him by sending his ambassadors to Egypt, that they might give him horses and many people. Will he prosper? Will he who does such a thing escape? Can he break a covenant and still be delivered? As I live, says the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwells who made him king, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he broke, with him in the midst of Babylon he shall die. Nor will Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company do anything in the war, when they heap up a siege mound and build a wall to cut off many persons. Since he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, and in fact gave his hand and still did all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, as I live, surely my oath which he despised and my covenant which he broke, I will recompense on his own head." And of course, this is talking about that last ruler who was set up. He rebelled against the king of Babylon and tried to get Egypt to go in company with him and I guess win back their own freedom. But, you know, it says here, points here, this covenant was between the king, or king of Israel, and the king of Babylon. But God here talks about it as his covenant. If we make a covenant, we make an oath that's before God as well. And this man, he's not going to succeed in breaking his oath as God will have it. And so any oaths we make must be kept. And of course, judgment of God on the king of Israel, it just illustrates these consequences. You know, we were studying Ecclesiastes 5:5-6. The same topic. It was talking about vows, which are promises, which are oaths. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the works of your hands? Our oaths stand before God, even if it's not an oath to God. And so, these men, like as the men of Solomon's time, made oaths to him, they were bound to keep them. If, you know, in whatever country you find yourself in, whichever ruler you find yourself in, if you've made an oath to serve, then that's what you must do. Otherwise, God will be against you. That's a pretty good reason, isn't it? It's not just turning against the king if he turned against you, but if you made an oath, it'll be God who won't let you stand either. And also in verse 5, what do we see was a good reason? Craig already mentioned it. Why do we keep the commands of the king? In verse 5.
We won't get in trouble. We won't get hurt.
Yeah, we won't get hurt. We won't be harmed. See the same topic in Romans 13:3. The rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. And we'll probably be coming back here in a few minutes. But we know that the ruler is not going to get mad at you for obeying him. He might praise you. If he doesn't praise you, you will be left unharmed. It's those who practice evil, who go against his commandments and rebel, that are going to receive hurt. And so, you know, as we're talking about life under the sun, this, you know, goes along with how are you going to get through life? How do you, you know, increase your, you know, not your profit, but just make things the most advantageous to you as you can get them. You know, with a ruler like this, it's best to just follow along and obey him. And and that will best serve you through your life.
I just think about studied about the delegated authority. We're talking about delegated authority here. And it's us being under someone, then it's our responsibility to do it, you know, what they say, up to an extent, obviously. And if they don't do the things that you just wrote about, because they may not, they may be evil and they may mistreat you and, you know, whatever. But they're going to, you know, answer to God. That we don't have to. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to be under that delegated authority. If they don't use it for your good, we can't control that.
Yeah.
So, because what I was thinking is that may not be the case all the time. Just because you serve, you do what's right.
It's not necessarily, it's not an absolute truth, of course, is it? But it's, like I said, I think it increases your chances. It's more likely to help than to hurt. And of course, you know, if you do the opposite, if you are disobedient to a ruler, to, you know, anyone of authority, it's probably most definitely going to hurt you. Not just, it might. You mind if you get caught, I guess. If you get caught, you're going to get punished. It's going to be against your own self-good. I also wanted to look ahead to verse 4 of chapter 10. They talk about, you know, those who are obedient won't be hurt, but even if somehow the ruler is angered against you, in verse 4 of chapter 10, it says, if the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post. For conciliation pacifies great offenses. And you see here the idea of a steadfast obedience. You know, I think, you know, if you obey steadfastly, even that could turn change the ruler's mind, his outlook toward you. You know, if someone accuses you of something falsely, even if it's falsely, if you run, well, that doesn't look as well as if you stand your post. And you're willing to deal with the fact, you know, how that, you know, all the time you see that, like, what, OJ's not guilty. Next thing you know, we see him driving down the highway, 90 miles an hour in a white Bronco. And you go, really? He's not? What's he doing? He's taking off. You know, that's not going to bring the ruler around to a positive outlook on you. So steadfast obedience. And I think this shows also in verse 3. Well, we read. Actually, I don't know. Did I read all of them? I didn't read them. And beginning of verse 2 says, I said, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. And verse 3, do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the word of the king is, there is power, and who may say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful, and a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. And in 3, we see, don't leave the presence of the king hastily. And like, as I said before, I think that shows, you know, it can show disrespect and it shows your anger and your dissatisfaction with whatever his judgment is. And that isn't going to make him favor you anymore. It's going to turn him against you. You know, you want to show respect. You don't want to show impertinence or a rebellious attitude. And so it's a matter of, you know, steadfast obedience and controlling, you know, controlling that attitude and your actions around him.
Right, is that what you're saying? Do not take your stand for an evil thing means showing disrespect, impertinence, or a rebellious attitude?
I'm not saying that's what that part means. I think that's what leaving the king hastily could show.
Shows. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, that's just fairly. That's even. I think that's the most straightforward thing. If you're gonna take up for something that's evil. We're talking about being obedient and doing good. If you stand up for something that's evil, his hand's going to be against you, right? So it goes against
the... Why would his hand be against you if he's evil? If he's wicked, if you take a stand for an evil thing and he's wicked, why would his hand be against you?
Well, the wicked people always do wicked things against you. I don't know. I mean, I thieves kill thieves. But they're both wicked. Why'd they do that? They should be together. I don't know, they do. I think, you know, for one...
Remember the definition of evil in the book that you've been stressing on.
Yes. Well, there was two of them. But one was the sorrow, pain as evil. And then there's also the one that was morally reprehensible. And we're more often to see the sorrow and pain. I just take this as, you know, it could be, as Mr. Porterfield pointed out, it could be rebellion against the king. You know, it could be any number of things which are not right, that even though he's wicked, you rape the king's daughter, what's going to happen? He's going to go, oh, good job. Because I'm wicked too. It's not going to happen, is it? I'm not trying to say that's what it is, but just because he's evil, like I believe he's wicked, doesn't mean just because you're wicked, you're going to get along. You know, he's the one in power. You're going to do what he says. That's that. So don't take a stand against him. I was really not going to get into that bit too much. But, I mean, I just thought, you know, it's kind of, yeah. Don't do something evil. If it's something evil, the king's not going to like it. And, you know, it doesn't go to tell us what it is. So, you know, to say it's this or say it's that is a lot of assumptions. But
the whole thing is you're chafing under this guy's rule. He warns you against his stern face. He says something you don't like it, so you get hard-nosed about it. He sees that, verse 1. And so he tells you something you may or may not like, verse 2, do it. Don't, as you already pointed out, don't hastily leave, showing disrespect for what he did. You know, if you're talking to your kid, they don't like it, they may look the other way or go out of the room. All they're saying is, I don't like what you said. I may not even do it. And so it's in that context, do not join in. Now, if you don't like what a king did,
yeah.
Back in the 1700s, people in this country did not like what the king was doing. So what did they do?
They rebelled.
Right. They joined in a matter to overthrow the king. He said, better be careful. Do not join in. Evil matter in this case is something you would join in because of the sternness of the situation. If you don't like what you're going to, you say rebel against it someday. Well, yeah. He will do whatever he pleases. This guy is powerful. Yeah. And so it's just practical wisdom to live under these circumstances.
Yeah. Is that the idea of dissatisfaction and anger this person experiences? They want to rebel against it, or maybe even strike back, which people do.
Esther is a perfect example of your verse 6, 5 and 6, about the proper kind of procedure. She wanted to approach King Ahasuerus. She was scared because you don't come, she's walking to the presence of the king. And you stand there, he doesn't extend the golden scepter, he hadn't called for you. You're dead. So she dresses herself all up, tries to make herself look appealing, stands respectfully until he bids her come in. There's a proper time and way to do this. And even then, when he asks her, what do you want? He said, well, let's, you and Haman come to my dinner tomorrow. She's trying to frame all this in the right way to make it most advantageous to this guy. He didn't have to listen to her. He can kill her too. And so there's a case of this Persian ruler who had that kind of power that he's talking about right here. She's a classic example of wisdom under those circumstances. So being a Jew, she could have got mad. Granted,
brave, what good would that have done? No, it's not beneficial to your own self.
Tobacco is kind of a backdoor approach. It's not really the thing. He's talking, as you said, about a monarch. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, is there a lesson in this for me as the ruler of my household? That I want my wife and my children to feel like the people under this king does. Well, we better be careful about Dad. He's an explosive. He runs his house, he'll do whatever he wishes. Nobody questions him. But we've got to tiptoe around and be careful because of what he does. We all want to run a house that way. Same thing as a parent. Yeah, I'm a parent, my kid, I'll do what I want. But do we want to be the kind of parent that is capricious, easily set off, the kids can't figure us out? Is that the kind of parent we want to be? So in any position of authority, as a, in, a, in a job, as a boss, is this the kind of scenario we want to present for our workers? Might make us feel good to have that kind of authority in time.
Yeah.
But here's the other, the shoe on the other foot when you're living under that, the difficulties of it. So the circumstances I can control, I'm the one in authority. Is there a lesson in that for me?
Yeah. Of course, this, you know, doesn't necessarily only to like a monarch or ruler. I mean, anyone who has authority over you, you can apply these same things in that situation. I mean, yeah, my boss doesn't have absolute authority over my life, but he has absolute authority in whether I keep my job day to day. So if I want to keep my job, I better, you know, follow along with some of these things. And if it's, you know, that's something I hear a lot. I've seen a lot, and I've heard a lot, you know, in reading columns about how to deal with managers and stuff. You know, the attitude you present, you know, they're going to judge you by that attitude. We're talking about the negative attitude here, you know, angry or dissatisfied. That doesn't help you in the job place. So just, yeah, you can go. It's a lot of wisdom here to apply in our lives. I think we already sort of touched all over this one, but you know, we were talking about, you know, why is this behavior advisable? We talked about the you know, the oath that one may have already made. You aren't going to come to any harm by being obedient. And also, like we've already talked all around it, that this ruler has power and he does whatever he pleases. In verse 3 and 4, none shall question him. None shall ask him, you know, what are you doing? He can do whatever he wants. That very aspect shows, gives us reason why we should, you know, be cautious. Why we should take this cautious approach, and you know, for our own self good. 1 Kings 2:24 and 26. I think this is a case from Solomon himself. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has confirmed me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has established a house for me, and as he promised, and Adonijah shall be put to death today. So King Solomon sent by the hand of Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and struck him down, and he died. This is where Adonijah just asked for the Shunammite, the David's, I guess, wasn't a concubine, I guess helper. It was female helper. She was very beautiful. He asked for her as a wife. And Solomon took this as a threat to the kingdom, as a rebellion, and had him killed. No one could say anything against it. We also see, you know, of course, in King Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. Daniel 5:18-19. O King, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father the kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished he executed, and whoever he wished he kept alive. Whomever he wished he set up, and whoever he wished he put down. And this shows the wishes of, you know, of this ruler, whether he's wicked or not. He certainly can be capricious, and he does whatever he pleases. Whatever his impulse is, he can carry it out. For that purpose, it's wise to realize that and to walk cautiously, as we said, you know, be obedient, maintain the proper attitude, and always showing respect. And it'll be to your own benefit. And of course, if we're dealing about rulers of then and the rulers even of today, when you look at Daniel 5, where we're at. We know rulers are given power. They have this power, and they're given this power as appointed by God. And Daniel 5:21 points it out. It says, of course, it's talking about Nebuchadnezzar to Nebuchadnezzar's son. It says, Nebuchadnezzar was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and appoints over it whomever he chooses. And also, when we turn back to Romans, I do keep my spot here. In Romans 13:1-5, we already read that here it's telling us we need to be obedient to the rulers, the authorities. Verses 1-5 says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake." And of course, this isn't necessarily in the context of what we're talking about in Ecclesiastes, but it is a truth. We know that these rulers are appointed by God. It doesn't do good to rebel against them or be displeased with them. We can't change what is on our own. And to rebel against, you know, any authority that's over us is real rebel against God as he set up that authority. So those are some good reasons, I think, for applying this behavior, keeping the commandments of the authorities. And verse 5 through 6, we looked at, it talks about what a wise man knows. What does a wise man know in verses 5? Anyone ever think of it?
Proper way to approach a ruler.
Yes, proper way to approach a ruler. It says, "A wise man's heart discerns or understands both time and judgment." And I take this to mean that exactly that. It's he knows how to obey. He judges the proper actions or manners in which to comply and to show obedience. I guess it can be difficult here, because right at 6 and 7, I think it changes, it shifts. We see in the end of 6, it says, a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. And it says, "Because for every matter there is a time and judgment, so the misery of man increases greatly." And it says from verse 7, "For he does not know what will happen, so who can tell him when it will occur?" And I think it's an error to take what the wise man knows as the time and judgment. They see judgment, they think, oh, the judgment pronounced upon the king is the end of his reign for his, you know, inappropriate rule or whatever. But that doesn't coincide with, it says what the wise man knows, and then in verse 7 it says, for he does not know what will happen, and who can tell what will occur. So I just wanted to point that out, that what the wise man knows is the proper procedure in which to follow, the manners and the actions in which to obey. And then, beginning there, I think I had 7 through 10, I meant 6 through 10. Talking about the end of the wicked rule, or the end of the rule, the end of the one who rules. As I just said, it says, no one knows when it will happen or how it will occur. We don't know when the end of a ruler will come about and how it will come about. You know, specifically the specific details. We know, of course, when the ruler dies, as all men do, that will be the end of it. But you don't know how that's going to happen or when. And I think it's still talking about the ruler here. As it says, you know, no one has power. I'll need to read it. 6 through 10. "For every matter there is a time and judgment, but the misery of man increases greatly. For he does not know what will happen, so who can tell him when it will occur? No one has power of the Spirit to retain the Spirit, and no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given into it." I think there that power continues on with, he has power, but that power is not going to save him from the inevitable.